Well, hello. My name is Richard Clem, and welcome to Introduction to American Law. It's a continuing legal education program I'm putting together. This recording is taking place on March 25th, 2020. One thing you might discover about this CLE is perhaps it's a little bit rough around the edges. I've been planning this program for a while, preparing to get something ready. What happened was we had a coronavirus pandemic. Lawyers and the rest of the citizens have been locked inside, unable to attend live CLE functions. And one thing the Minnesota Supreme Court recently did was that for attorneys in Minnesota who have to report their CLE hours this year, it's called CLE Category 3. But if you're reporting this year, that is, you would normally need to finish your classes by June 30th and report by August 31st. That could get very difficult for some Minnesota attorneys to be able to finish that. So what the Minnesota Supreme Court did was open up the process so that there's no cap on on-demand hours. As a result of that, there's a big demand for on-demand programs, I decided to rush this program through to completion. Hopefully it's not too rough around the edges. And as time goes by, I'll probably do some revisions and make it a little bit more of a smooth course that you might be accustomed to. But in the meantime, I think we have a lot of interesting material that we can go over, even if it's in slightly rough form. We'll get your CLE hours out of the way. And I think in the process, learn some interesting and useful information. This course is designed primarily for attorneys taking it to fulfill their continuing legal education hours. And what the program is going to be, it's going to be a very, very broad overview of the American legal system and American law. We're not going to be covering anything that you probably didn't cover in law school. We'll have discussions of an overview of tort law and of criminal law and constitutional law, all the subjects that you covered in law school. So you're probably not going to be learning anything new. However, it's very likely that you will have your mind refreshed as to some things that you learned in law school and really haven't encountered very much since then, because most attorneys specialize to a certain extent. In fact, when we get to the area in which you are a specialist, you will probably quickly notice that I am guilty of gross oversimplification of some of the topics we cover. So when we spend an hour or two taking a look at all of criminal law, if you practice criminal law on a day-to-day basis, I imagine you'll probably cringe because we'll be oversimplifying things to such an extent. And certainly when we get to the area that you are familiar with like that, you will be much more of an expert on the subject than I am. In fact, I encourage any feedback. If I say anything wrong when we're covering an area that you know something about, please let me know. And when I update the course and hopefully make it a little bit smoother in its presentation, hopefully I can work your suggestions into the program. I think the value of a program like this is you are a specialist, and you become an expert in one or two specialties, but other areas, you probably haven't had too much exposure to them since law school. So if you practice criminal law on a day-to-day basis, you have a basic understanding of property law, but it's probably been a while since you heard the main points of that particular field of law. So I think it will serve some value because when you do have property law questions that infringe in your criminal law practice, well, at least you'll know the starting point. You'll know where to look. You'll be refreshed as to what the general principles of law in that other field are. So I think you will get some value out of today's program. I anticipate that at some point non-attorneys might get something of value out of this course. You might somebody desiring just a broad overview of how American law works. I think we'll find this course very helpful. So somebody contemplating going to law school. Perhaps I will be able to talk you out of it. And if you take this course and it's just the most horrible thing you've ever heard, well, that might give you kind of a hint that maybe law school is not the best place for you to go. And perhaps you ought to find your way to medical school and find a cure for some disease or something. So even if we decide you don't like the law and you're in that category, I think we will have served our purpose. On the other hand, there is a lot of interesting stuff here. So if you have some inklings that perhaps you want to go to law school by studying a broad overview like this, number one, you might be able to confirm that notion that becoming an attorney is something you might want to do. And also, it will have a little bit of helpfulness to you if you when you do start law school, because when you go to law school, you're not really taught very much about the law. As they told us, instead you learn to think like a lawyer. That's their purpose at law school. So in the 3 or so years that you spend in law school, they're not really teaching you very much law, but instead what they're trying to do is to get you to think like a lawyer, and perhaps in the process learning a little bit about the law also. But if you go into that process already knowing a little bit about the law, I think you will find that helpful, so that when your professor tries to hide the ball from you, well, at least you might have some inkling of where the ball is. So I think you might find it helpful for that purpose as well. But again, we're focusing primarily on attorneys. And the program is being offered for continuing legal education credit probably first in Minnesota, probably in other states as well. So you will get your hours out of this program. And I think you will also learn some information that will be helpful to you when you encounter those areas of the law that are maybe a little bit up outside your field of specialty. It'll give you more of an idea of the big picture and maybe reintroduce you to some concepts that you maybe haven't thought of a lot about since law school. So I think it'll be a helpful refresher in that regard. Our text for this program, which I highly recommend getting a hold of, our text for this program is entitled Law 101, with the subtitle Everything You Need to Know About American Law, by J.M. Feinman, F-E-I-N-M-A-N. The book is currently in its fifth edition. This fifth edition is copyright 2018. If you have an older edition, that's probably close enough to follow along in. But I do highly recommend getting a hold of the book. On the course description for this course, I will have a link where you can find it on Amazon or any of the other usual places. It's available as a dead tree book, I think, in both hardcover and paperback. It's available as a Kindle book, it's available as an audiobook as well. So if you get tired of hearing my voice and you want to hear somebody else's voice talk about some of the same concepts, you can get the audio edition of the book. So like I say, I do commend, um, I commend that book to you. If you once you finish with it, you can give it to your non-attorney friends when they ask you, questions about American law. I think it'll serve as a useful reference for that purpose. And today, in part one, we're going to be covering up through page 24 of the text. We're going to start out with a kind of some introductory material, and then we will jump into constitutional law and start talking about the beginning of that. But we turn first to chapter one of our text, and I think it's a good title that he has to that book, or to that chapter. The title of his first chapter is No Secret Books. I think we as lawyers occasionally are maybe guilty of giving our clients and the public the impression that we deal in some secret knowledge, that we have some secret books that tell what the law is. And I guess that would be a nice position for us to be in, that would certainly help preserve our monopoly in our profession if we did have access to these secret books containing the law, and members of the general public were not allowed to see what was inside the secret books. But that's really not the case, because as you're aware, if you go down to the law library at your local law school, there are thousands or millions of volumes in there of books, and the thing that stands out for me that I always remember when I see the law library is they're written in the English language, I remember when I started law school, it was with a bit of trepidation. I was warned that it was going to be hard. You actually have to start studying if I wanted to get through it, that law school was really, really hard, and you'd just be studying constantly, learning all of this arcane material, and it was going to be really hard. The one thing that kind of made me feel a little bit better about the whole thing was, and I don't even remember where I read this, but it was in some of the introductory material that we were given, explaining what the law school process was going to be like. One of the authors of that material pointed out that all of these laws are written in English, and sure enough, every single thing that I read in law school almost. I guess there might have been a couple of exceptions, but in general, everything that I had to learn about the law was indeed taken from statutes and cases and other materials that were indeed written in the English language. They were written in a way that maybe this goal was not fully realized, but all this material was written in such a way that the author expected, or at least hoped, that people would be able to figure out what they were saying. It was written in English. So indeed, they are not secret books. They are books that are available to anybody. We're going to give you the keys of how to find things in some of those books, and give you a little, or actually more so, we're going to give you a little bit of summary what's in those non-secret books, but with the assurance that this entire course and all of those books indeed are written in the English language. And like I say, this the subject material of this course is going to be pretty much the same subject material that you studied in your 3 years of law school. The topic we're going to start with, probably in a little bit different order. They didn't feed us con law right from the start. They kind of saved that for a little while, and that's actually where we're going to be starting today. We're going to start with constitutional law. We're going to look at the United States Constitution and what exactly the meaning and effect of that document is. We're going to look at constitutional law. We're going to look at civil procedure. And in other words, what are the procedures we follow when you sue somebody or when you get sued? Somebody owes you some money. That's all well and good. But the reason why we need lawyers out there is because we need to navigate this civil litigation system. We need to know what the procedures are for civil cases like that. So we will look at civil procedure. We will look at torts. Now, for any non-lawyers listening, that's always that's one of those funny words that it kind of looks like maybe it's not an English word. It sounds like something else, but no, I think that is an old English word. Torts. A tort is when somebody commits a civil wrong, when somebody does something that harms you. If somebody comes up and punches you, well, you can sue them for that because it's a tort. That's the tort of battery. If somebody is driving their car in an unsafe manner and they crash into you and injure you, well, they committed a tort. You can sue them for that tort because they were guilty of negligence. We will look at the law of contracts. Contracts, when you think of contracts, you think of the business world. So that's why when we got to law school, we were all very surprised in my law school and probably most law schools. The very first case that we got was the case of the hairy hand. So instead of talking about somebody selling $1,000 worth of widgets and not delivering, you know, the kind of thing that you would think of as a contract case, instead we get the case of the hairy hand of this poor hapless person who went into the doctor's office to get some to get his hand fixed up, and the doctor did some surgery on it, and it wound up growing hair as a result of that. And it turns out that was a contract case because he promised that he would deliver a good hand at the end of the procedure rather than a hairy hand. The guy got a hairy hand. So that became a very famous contract case. So we'll see that the law of contracts, it was probably never intended to deal with malformed hands. It was probably intended to serve the ends of commerce. But we will be taking a look at what exactly is a contract and what does that entail. That's one of the subjects we'll be talking about. We will be talking about property. You own your home, or you rent your home, or you own a piece of farm property. What are your rights and obligations with respect to that property, both real property, things like land, and personal property, things like money and tangible items that you might carry around, and intangible property. You can own a patent. What a patent, you can't put that in a box or anything, but that is a very important piece of property. So we'll be talking about property law in one of these sections. We will be talking about criminal law. What are the things that that the state can put you in jail for? You're not just causing harm to that one person that you punched, but you're causing harm to society to the point where the state or the government decides to put you in jail. Even if the person that was the victim of the crime maybe doesn't think it's that big of a deal, but there's a separate set of obligations that you owe to the state that are embodied in the criminal law. And then finally, we will look at criminal procedure, because that's maybe really more important than what the actual criminal law is. You probably have a pretty good idea of what the criminal law is. You're not supposed to steal somebody else's money. You're not supposed to cause injury to other people. You're not supposed to, punch them or stab them or shoot them. You probably didn't need to go to law school to figure out those things. So the actual criminal law, you know, maybe we don't need to talk so much about. But the criminal procedure is a lot more important, because by having criminal law, we place a lot of power in the state. You know, the state has the power to lock you up and throw away the key. And we want to make sure that that power is not exercised too arbitrarily. So we have the criminal procedure, not just of what time is the trial and that sort of thing, but we have a lot of procedural safeguards built into a criminal procedure. So that's why I think that's a very important subject. Like I say, probably more important than actual criminal law. Now, the author points out that he says that, most law is not in the law books. So we just, I just told you that these books are out there, and they're not secret books. They're written in the English language. I guess that's the good news. But on the other hand, the law really is not in those books. The law is really how it gets applied on a day-to-day basis. So the author uses an example of, you know, the speed limit in this street. How fast can you drive on this street? Well, you go look at the law. You go look at the statute or the ordinance, or maybe the sign, and the law says you can drive 65 miles an hour. But if you get pulled over for going 66 miles an hour, you'd probably get the police officer would probably get laughed out of court for giving you a ticket for 1 mile over the limit. So it's not quite so. In other words, the question of is it legal to do this is usually not quite so simple. Now, you've probably noticed from your non-lawyer friends will often, especially kids, your kids will always ask you the question of along the lines of, is it legal to, and you fill in the blank, is it legal to do this? Is it legal to do that? Well, that's usually not a very helpful question. Because, I can ask, is it legal to drive 66 miles an hour down this street with a speed limit of 65? Is it legal to do that? I guess that's easy because it's either a yes or no question. But it seems to me the better question, the question why you would ever need a lawyer to answer it, is not just to say, is it legal or is it illegal? Because it's legal because there's a sign there. It says speed limit 65. But really, I think the right question is the reason why you need to consult lawyers, the reason why you need to consult these law books is to be able to answer the question, what is the effect? What happens? What happens if I drive 66 miles an hour? I think that makes the question a lot more difficult. But I think we have to keep in mind that is more of a meaningful question than simply asking, is it legal? Because what's the effect? Whether it's legal or whether it's illegal, what is the effect of it? What's going to happen? You can ask somebody, what's the speed limit? The speed limit is 65. That doesn't tell you a whole lot. But on the other hand, if somebody asks, what happens if I drive 66 miles an hour? Well, that one you can probably answer, probably nothing bad will happen if you drive 66 miles an hour in the 65 mile an hour zone. On the other hand, if somebody asks, what will happen if I drive 100 miles an hour? Because remember, if they ask you, is it legal to drive 100 miles an hour? You say no. Just like, is it legal to drive 66? No. But what's the effect if I drive 100 miles an hour? The effect of that is, you'll have some splaining to do down at the station. That's going to be kind of a big deal just for doing it. And certainly if you get into an accident while doing it, then there are going to be a lot more legal effects. So again, I think the question, is it legal, is not helpful. But instead of the question, what is the effect of this particular behavior? The author, since he's writing mostly for non-attorneys, he stresses that this is not a how-to book. So by taking this course or by reading this book, you're really not going to get any practical ideas on how to do anything with respect to the law. You won't be able to. I won't be a lot of help if you're a non-attorney taking this course and you want to sue somebody in small claims court. Well, I'm not going to be able to give you a lot of practical guidance there. Although you will get some of the kind of the overarching principles. You'll seem a little bit smarter when you talk to the judge in your small claims court case. So it's useful for that purpose, although not maybe immediately useful. At this point, I'm going to give the first of many code numbers that I will be giving during the course of the program. Depending on what kind of credit you're taking this program for, I might need to have some proof that you were actually here, that you were actually paying attention. So that was explained when you signed up for the course. I told you to write down a series of code numbers. And the first code number is 1-102. 1-102. 1-102 is the first code number for this program. Now, the next point our author makes is that people make the law. Well, that seems like kind of a common sense thing. Why would he have to say that? Well, the reason why he has to say that is because, we as lawyers sometimes try to give the impression that this was not a man-made construct. We kind of try to give the impression that we are scientists. Trying to navigate this landscape that we call the law. This law was just kind of plopped down on top of the world, and we, the lawyers, are the experts, and we can go through and we can navigate this thing called the law. So we give that impression pretty frequently, but the author strikes that down and says, no, it's not something like that. People make the law. Now, it comes from a lot of different people, some of them acting intentionally, some of them acting not necessarily intentionally to create the law. But ultimately, it is a human-made phenomenon, the law. It's not just this natural entity that kind of blew in and caused these legal principles to be there. People make the law. Although, as a lawyer, I have to step in there and say that it's not entirely a man-made phenomenon. For example, how does the Declaration of Independence begin? Well, it begins by pointing out that we, the people, were endowed not by other people, but we were endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. So simply by being created beings, there is a certain amount of law that just naturally arises without any human intervention whatsoever. We have these natural rights that were endowed by our Creator. We have the right to life. We have the right to liberty. We have a right to pursuit of happiness, simply because our Creator said so, not because any man or any human said those things. Of course, at some point, some human had to write those down. So I guess the author is right. But I guess I will take a little bit of issue with the author when he says that people make the law, because I think it's important when we look at other human beings to respect the fact that they have these natural rights to their life, to their liberty, to their pursuit of happiness. And even if no man told me that I should not take away your life, or I should not take away your liberty, or I should not take away your property, even though no human told me those things, well, my conscience tells me that I'm not supposed to do those things. So like I say, I will take issue a little bit with the author when he says that people make the law, because as an attorney, I am a scientist navigating this landscape that we call the law. and at least some parts of that that landscape, just like the natural landscape, were not put there by any human effort, but were placed there by a creator who made the mountains and to a certain extent made the law. Even though we as humans have certainly made many modifications of that landscape. But in summary for chapter one, I just want to stress what the author says, that you can indeed understand the law. If you're an attorney, you got a little bit of inkling in law school that you can understand all these seemingly unrelated things of property law and criminal law and torts and contracts. As you go out and practice in one area, you can still understand these other areas. But again, for any laypersons who are listening, yes, you can understand the law. There are no secret books. The books that are there are written in English, and for the most part, humans wrote most of this law, you as a human should be pretty well equipped to read that law. Well, turning to chapter two, now we get to chapter two, covering the topic of constitutional law. What is constitutional law? You're familiar with a document called the Constitution, the United States Constitution. So it's the area of law that that is embodied in that document, and the law that that talks about that document. Even countries like England or like Britain that do not have a written constitution, they still speak in terms of constitutional law, not constitution in terms of a piece of paper called the Constitution, but the word constitution simply means how is something constituted. So the lawyer in Britain can just as easily say he or she wants to talk about the constitution of their government. In other words, how is it constituted? Just like we in America can talk about constitutional law, how is the United States government and system of law, how is it constituted? We also, as kind of a related meaning to that, we in America can speak in terms of one piece of paper. Housed in Washington, D.C., the Constitution. We can talk about that piece of paper when we're talking about constitutional law. But the term constitutional law really refers to both of those. It talks about the piece of paper, but more importantly, it talks about the structure and functions of government and how that government relates to its citizens. How is the government structured? Constitutional law talks about things that, the United States government is structured in three branches. We have executive, legislative, and judicial. Or you could say our country's government is structured in a federal system. We have a federal government and we have state governments. And we have a piece of paper, the Constitution, that defines that structure. It says, the executive branch is defined in this way, and there are some general rules, some specific provisions. There's a general rule saying that the president has to faithfully execute the laws of the United States, and there are some very specific provisions. It says that the president has to be 35 years old. So the Constitution in America, that piece of paper, the Constitution, defines the structure of our government. In other countries, there's not a piece of paper necessarily. So in Britain, you can't say that this piece of paper defines the structure of the government, but other materials, other tradition defines the structure of the British government. But either way, constitutional law defines the structure of the government and defines the function of the government. Why do we have a government? What's it supposed to do? What is it not supposed to do? The Constitution, our written document, our Constitution says, the federal government has the following functions. It shall create a post office. That's one of the functions of government. Or if you look at a state constitution, a lot of times a lot of the verbiage in a state constitution refers to education. So, for example, our Minnesota state constitution says that the legislature has a responsibility to establish a uniform public school system throughout the state, or words to that effect. The document or the body of law, constitutional law, defines the various functions of government, and it talks about the relations with the citizens. How does the government interact with the citizens in this country that make up the government? Because the government, after all, is we the people. What interactions are there between the body politic of the government and the individual citizens? A definition of relations with the citizens. When are the citizens supposed to vote on certain things? What rights do the citizens have? So that's what constitutional law is. It defines the structure and function of government, and it defines the relation with the citizens. That structure of the government, we have it a little bit more difficult. We have to spend more time in law school, in constitutional law in this country than perhaps we would in other countries, because we have that other pesky layer that we have to worry about, the concept of federalism. We do not have one government in this country. Wherever you are, you basically have two governments. You have your state government and you have the federal government. So our constitutional law in this country has to define the relation, the relative powers between the states and the federal government. So those are some of the things we're going to be talking about. What's the most important part of the Constitution? Well, I guess maybe the most important part of the Constitution is the Supremacy Clause, because the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution says that this Constitution and the laws enacted in furtherance of it are the supreme law of the land. So if there's ever any dispute between a state constitution and the federal constitution, assuming that the federal constitution gives some power to the federal government, laws in furtherance of that power are the supreme law of the land. So that's what we're going to be talking about. Now, when you talk about constitutional law, there's always a tension there, and it's a healthy tension. You have to keep in mind that somebody has to make decisions on what exactly the proper constitutional powers are. So if somebody runs for president and they're 34 years old, they're not supposed to. It says right there in the Constitution. Who makes that decision? So that's an important thing to figure out. Now, that's a pretty easy decision to make, but let's say, somebody's running for president at the age of 34, and they say, well, I think that, I'm mature for my age. So I'm, emotionally, I'm a 36-year-old. I think I have the right to run for president. Well, somebody has to make that decision, though. Yeah, and you can't vest the power in every individual to say what that is. And ultimately, as we'll talk in a little bit more detail later on, ultimately that decision-making authority is vested in the courts. So ultimately, if a 34-year-old decides to run for president, who will decide whether that person is eligible? Ultimately, it's probably going to be the courts that will make that decision. Ultimately, it will be the United States Supreme Court that will make that decision. Now, there are enough filters in place that most decisions don't get there, but ultimately, it's going to be the United States Supreme Court that will decide these important constitutional issues. Back before I started, when I was in high school and such, before I started law school, the other name for the United States Supreme Court was nine old men. We had nine old men who were making these ultimate decisions, these important decisions. The most important decisions in the life of the nation were vested in 9 old men. That has changed now a little bit, but not very much, because today, who makes these ultimate important decisions that affect everyone in the country? It's 9 old men and women. Well, you ought to see that there's maybe a little bit of tension there, because this is a democratic society, right? The United States is based on, democratic principles. But these having 9 old men make your most important decisions, that is certainly not a very democratic principle. So there's a tension there. There's an extreme tension that you have these democratic powers. You know, it's we the people who are running the government. But on the other hand, we the people are limited by what that Constitution has to say. And ultimately, it's going to be the 9 old men and women who will decide whether we are acting properly when we exercise our democratic powers. In general, they do a pretty good job. Very rarely do they depart too much from common sense, but that's not a democratic institution. 9 old men, or even 9 old men and women, is not a democratic institution. It's a necessary institution. It's a very necessary institution, but we always have to keep in mind, we always have to remember that it's a very undemocratic institution. And for a country that is based on democratic principles, we have to be very careful of the power that we vest in these 9 people, whether they be 9 old men or 9 old men and women, or even if they're 9 young men and women. We have to be very careful in how we cede that power to them. So we as attorneys, who serve as the gatekeepers to those 9 old men, we who serve as those gatekeepers to that undemocratic institution, we bear a heavy responsibility that we always have to keep in mind. And our next code number for this part of the program, our next code number is 1-226. 1-226. 1-226 is our next code number. One caveat. Oh, I sound like a lawyer. I'm throwing out words like caveat. That's just a word that means warning, for any non-lawyers who are listening. But we lawyers like to sound lawyerly. We throw in these other words occasionally. But one caveat, one warning that I want to put out is that when we say constitutional law, when we talk about the Constitution, we always want to keep in mind that we really have 2 constitutions we always have to worry about. We have that U.S. Constitution, but we also have our own state constitution. So always remember that there's also a state constitution that defines the structure and the function of our state government and the relation of our the state to its citizens, and also to its relation to the federal government. So always remember that your state also has a constitution. So if you're ever wondering what exactly somebody's rights or responsibilities are, in addition to looking at the state, the federal constitution, you have to look at the state constitution. State constitutions are usually a lot longer. The federal constitution is a pretty short document, and you can sit down and read it from cover to cover in less than an hour. It's not that long. That's something that everybody should do occasionally. not just attorneys, but also non-attorneys. You might be surprised some of the stuff that's in there. The state constitutions, you probably can't do that or it would take a lot longer because they're much longer documents. The reason for that is, first of all, they're a little bit easier to amend. Usually, like in Minnesota, it requires a vote of the all the voters in the state. But compared to the federal constitution, it's easier to amend. So if somebody wants to add a provision in there, it's a lot easier to add it in. So over the years, it just has a tendency to get longer. But also, the state constitution really has to cover everything. So it is going to be a lot longer. You know, some of those, and some of them cover issues that are very important to people in that state, but not other states. So, for example, if you look at the Alaska state constitution, there are a lot of provisions in the Alaska state constitution relating to hunting and fishing that, you know, probably going to be absent from, you know, from, you know, the Connecticut Constitution or something, because that's a much more important issue. The people there feel they have a vested right in that, that they want to be memorialized in their state constitution. So they're longer because of some independent state interests. And they're also longer, though, because, as we will learn later on, well, you knew this if you went to law school, but as you know, the federal government is one of limited powers. The federal government has only its enumerated powers. You know, it has it can't just pass a law on any subject. It has to fit into a category covered by the Constitution. Some of them pretty broad, like the Commerce Clause. They can regulate. The federal government can regulate trade between the states. But any action of the federal government has to be under one of its enumerated powers. On the other hand, the states deal with the general police powers in general, it's just, it's kind of one of those things that was endowed by our creators, if you asked a lawyer, maybe, that, you know, the state has some natural inherent powers to police the citizenry, because it has those general powers, not just, you know, limited to some certain areas, there's a lot more to talk about, we have to like right now, for example, one of the big state constitutional issues clearly is public health. What can the governor do in the face of a public health emergency? I don't know exactly what the Minnesota State Constitution says, but I'm sure it contains a lot more information on that subject than the federal constitution does. So those are the couple of differences between the state constitution and the federal constitution. But always remember, one of my law professors in school said the most common malpractice committed by attorneys is attorneys failing to look at their state constitution, they went to law school and they learned all about this federal constitution. And then maybe your client has some right under the state constitution that you should have asserted, but you spent too much time worrying about only the rights under the federal constitution. So state constitutions are important. Why do we have this constitutional law? Because we need a strong government. My particular leanings are a little bit more on the libertarian side. I don't want a strong government. So if you walked up to me and said, "Do you believe in big government?" I would say, "Well, no, of course I don't believe in big government. I believe in small government." But on the other hand, even a limited government person like me concedes that, in some ways, yeah, we do have to have a strong government, because if somebody breaks into my house, I want a strong police department to come and track that person down and bring them to justice. So I want a government that's strong enough to throw people in jail. And that's that, you know, and, you know, for somebody who's, I just said I don't like big government, but now I'm saying I don't like big government, except I want you to throw that guy in jail. I believe in a strong big government, I guess, even though, comparatively speaking, I'm a small government kind of person. So the government has to have powers like that to imprison people. And the government has to have the power to tax people. If you come up to me and you say, are you in favor of high taxes? Of course not. I'm a card-carrying conservative. I believe in low taxes. But on the other hand, I have to concede that, the government has a legitimate power to tax people, to get money to pay to put that guy in prison that I wanted to. So, again, maybe a little bit of a big government. The government certainly has the power to regulate people. I'll concede that. So if you, do I think your company should be put out of business because, you killed some fly somewhere? Well, probably not. But on the other hand, if you're dumping toxic waste into the public waters and into the air that I want to enjoy, I would certainly say no. You do not have the right to cause pollution. So the government legitimately has the power to regulate you. And indeed, I also believe that the government has the right to have a strong military. I'm a small government kind of guy, but I want an army with a lot of tanks and airplanes and ships and everything else to deter any aggression against the country and preserve our legitimate interests. I say I'm against big government, but I want a government that's big enough to wreak havoc on somebody else. I want a military. So the government has to be strong. But I don't want it to be too strong. So there we have a delicate balance that we have to make sure. And in this country, I guess there are other ways you could do it, but as Winston Churchill said, a democratic government is the worst possible form of government, with the exception of everything else that's been tried. That's how our Constitution keeps things in check. We have we're governed by democratic principles. We can't throw people in jail unless the majority of the people are in favor of the law that says you'll get thrown into jail if you burglarize somebody else's house. So it's checked by our democratic system. As we ought to always remember, that democratic principled government can certainly be problematic in some cases. Because what does a democratic form of government mean? Well, that means that that if 51% of the people are in favor of something, then that's what we're going to do. So if 51% of the people vote to enslave the other 49%, that's a perfectly legitimate, exercise of the democratic power. I mean, that's what democracy is. 51% of the people said that it was okay. So that means it is okay. My Latin is a little bit rusty, but if you go into the it's not rusty, it's non-existent, but if you go into the chamber of the Minnesota legislature and look up at the ceiling, it says something like vox populi vox dei, the voice of the people is the voice of God. So if 51% of the people said that we're going to enslave the other 49% of the people, well, that's the voice of the people, so I guess it's the voice of God. But we all know that that would not be proper. So the important part of the Constitution, the reason why we have those nine old men, and hopefully we have nine responsible old men and women in that role, is because the rights of the 51% still have to respect the rights of the minority. No, the 51% of the people cannot simply vote to enslave the other 49%. And if they did, well, we hope the nine old men and women will step in and say, no, you're not allowed to do that. So we have to have a constitution. We have to have some underlying principles of how we're going to exercise that power so that that it's exercised properly. So we don't run into something like 51% of the population enslaving the other 49%. The courts to do that. We can pat ourselves on the back, saying, "Well, we have courts to serve as arbitrators, you know they're less political." So that's a good way to do things. Well, what is the very okay? We're going to be talking during this program about a lot of different court cases, a lot of famous court cases. What's the very first court case we read about in the book? After telling how great it is that we have this this court system to protect the rights of individuals, they issue these hallowed decisions that are handed down with these wise decisions telling the rest of us how to govern our affairs. And what's the first such decision that is mentioned in the book? It's the Dred Scott case. And of course, the Dred Scott case, I believe, was about 1850-ish or so, somewhere in there. Mr. Scott, a man named Dred Scott, was a slave in a state where there was slavery, he spent some time in free territory. He was at Fort Snelling in the current Minnesota. His master was an officer serving at Fort Snelling, he brought his slave Dred Scott with him. Dred Scott said, "Well, wait a minute. I'm in free territory now. I'm not in a slave state. I'm in a state where the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 said that in this territory, the Northwest, that there shall never be slavery nor involuntary servitude, and sure enough, he was in that territory. So he went to court and said, well, because I was in the Northwest Territory, because my master dragged me to Fort Snelling, I am now a free man. And I have the right to be released from my bondage." The case worked its way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, "No, you don't have any rights because you're a black person, and black people don't have any rights. They're pretty smart lawyers, these judges who make it up to the Supreme Court. They based it on a technicality, because they looked at the Constitution and said, well, it's a jurisdictional issue, because I guess we don't have jurisdiction over this case." Okay, as I mentioned, this program might be a little bit rough around the edges, because here I'm sitting here recording in my office, and of course the phone is sitting right here, so when the phone rings, I have to pause everything, and you get to hear a ring. But what a timely call. That was actually a robocall. Here we are talking about constitutional law. What are the powers of the state? What are the powers of the governor? Well, that was a robocall relaying to me orders from the governor. That was actually from our school district, relating that under the governor's latest order, schools will be closed through at least May. Now, so that was the school district calling, relaying that, letting us know that distance learning will definitely take effect, just as it is for you as you're sitting here at your computer. My kids will also be engaging in distance learning and learning from their computer. So kind of a timely interruption there. But we're talking about the Dred Scott case, and we have these, because we're just saying, we're so proud of our Supreme Court. What's the very first case we talk about is, the worst court decision in the history of court decisions, because the holding was that an African-American person was not a citizen. And it was kind of the lawyers on the Supreme Court thought they were being clever. They thought they found an easy way out on this by basing it on this jurisdictional issue. Because under the Constitution, it limits the power of the courts. And one of the areas where the courts do have power to adjudicate is is disputes between citizens of different states. So the Dred Scott case was a diversity case. It was a case between citizens of different states. So before they turned to the merits of the case, the Supreme Court said, oh, we don't have to reach the merits. We can decide this case on a jurisdictional issue. Because you, Mr. Scott, because you're African American, well, you're not really a person. You're not really a citizen. This is not a case between citizens of two different states, because to be a citizen, well, first you have to be a person, and you're not even a person. So therefore, we'll cleverly dispense with this case on jurisdictional grounds. And of course, the Dred Scott case has never been overruled. That was the law of the land. It was never overruled by the court. That case is still good law, because it's never been overruled. But it has indeed. It is thankfully no longer the law. Because even though it was never overruled by the court, well, the Constitution was changed to make sure that the Dred Scott case is no longer the law. So in fact, the 14th Amendment says that if you are born, all you have to do to become a citizen is be born. It says anybody born in the United States is a citizen, regardless of the color of your skin. Basically the 51% of the population had to step in and change the Constitution, because the nine old men got that one wrong. So that was a case where 51% of the population, at least in 51% of a limited part of the population after the Civil War, was able to reverse that decision. The other example given the text, of course, is the Plessy v. Ferguson case from 1896. The case not quite as bad as the Dred Scott case, but Plessy v. Ferguson said everybody has equal protection, but separate but equal protection, that's fine. So if we have one set of railroad seats for black customers and one for white customers, that's okay as long as they're equal. And well, or maybe not quite equal, but they're both things that you can sit on, but as long if they're separate, that doesn't really matter as long as they're equal. And here I guess they're kind of equal. So that was okay. Well, of course, separate but equal, that's not right. But that's a case where the Supreme Court corrected itself in 1954 in the Brown versus Board of Education decision. So in that one, they didn't have to have somebody change the Constitution. The court came around in only 58 years. When I was growing up, Plessy v. Ferguson, that sounded like a long time ago. But the time between Plessy and Brown was only 58 years. So there the court kind of got its act together a little bit. So anyway, we have these nine old men that we put in charge of, and women that we put in charge of deciding what the Constitution means. How do they do that? And the author points out that, first of all, the Constitution is short and vague, because the text of the Constitution is pretty short, and it's pretty vague. So it says the Congress or the federal government, for example, has the power to regulate trade among the states. The Commerce Clause. The Congress has power to regulate trade between the states and between the states and foreign countries and with Native American tribes. That's pretty short statement, you know, what exactly does that mean? So we have to have our nine old men can't just look at the text of this written constitution. They, just kind of like in Britain, you can't just, there is no document to look at. So you have to look a little bit deeper. And there are really two schools of thought on how to do that. And they both have strong adherence, but, if you think about it, they're both have some points, and they're both have to also realize that the other side has a point. The originalist. Now, if you ask me, I guess I would say I'm an originalist. I'm a strict constructionist. I think the Constitution should be narrowly interpreted, because the Constitution gave. You know, who gave the court power to decide these issues? Who gave the court the power to decide things? Because, you're going to get a lot of things that, what exactly is interstate commerce? Or what exactly does it mean when, say, Congress shall pass no law restricting the freedom of the press? What exactly does that mean? Well, me, as an originalist, as a strict constructionist, I would say, we have to look at the text of the Constitution, but the text of the Constitution isn't too helpful. It just says regulate trade among the states. That doesn't help us too much. So what we have to do is we have to look at the intent of the framers. When these mythical men, the framers, were framing the Constitution, I guess if you go to the Library of Congress, it's in a frame. So they're the ones who put it in that frame. We have to look at the intent of the framers, the people who wrote the Constitution. What were they thinking? What did they mean when they said regulate trade among the various states? What was their intent? And after we divine their intent, we apply their intent. And, they intended that if you're sending, a truckload of apples from Wisconsin to Minnesota, that's what they meant by it. And we simply apply that intent. So we have to try to figure out what they were thinking about, when they wrote this. The interpretist. It's a living constitution. So the framers, the idea would be, as an originalist, as a strict constructionist, I guess I would say, in public, we have to look at it really. Be an internet, or that there were going to be these, we're going to get one. And I guess we'll conclude this portion of the program just by noting something maybe the author put in here to kind of put me in my place as a strict constructionist. I don't know. But he points out that a lot of these concepts are ever-changing, ever-evolving. Because the Dred Scott case, when it was decided, it was thought... these nine old men, the U.S. Supreme Court at the time, they thought they were being very clever about it. They thought they had settled the issue of slavery once and for all. They provided some clarity. They handed down a decision that was kind of clever using that jurisdictional hook, and they thought that would resolve matters forever. They thought they were being reasonable, and a certain amount of the American public, probably a majority, believed that that was a proper resolution. But of course, if the Supreme Court came down with something like that today, that would be obviously beyond the pale. It was thought to resolve the issue back then. They honestly believed that they had settled this whole slavery controversy once and for all. Of course, they tragically failed in that endeavor. So we do have to remember that you know, when I, as a strict constructionist, say, oh, that's what it said. Well, maybe there is a little bit more to it. On the other hand, I'll say to the interpretivists who think the Constitution is a living document. Well, these guys who wrote the thing a couple hundred plus years ago, they were certainly flawed. They certainly made a lot of mistakes in there. But on the other hand, they were pretty intelligent people. They thought these things through pretty well. So I think even if we don't decide that it's totally dispositive, I think it's always a worthwhile endeavor to at least ask the question of what would the framers' intent have been. Even if I guess I'll concede it might be impossible for us to say that what was the intent of the framers. So anyway, there we come to the end of lesson one of this program. We will, in lesson number two, we will pick it up and we will keep talking some more about constitutional law. And I look forward to seeing you at that program as well.